wide, and it's becoming increasingly impossible to afford diesel fuel for private generators in order to compensate for the lack of electricity, because the price of diesel fuel on the black market is 18-fold what it was a year ago. The price of a basic food basket has tripled. The price of gasoline for cars has tripled, and it's also very difficult to find. So actually, this economic collapse, which was already underway, what the port explosion has done, instead of being a turning point or a moment of reckoning, has just pushed us further into the abyss of total economic freefall.
We want to thank you so much, Nisreen, for joining us. Nisreen Salty, economics professor at the American University of Beirut. And you can go to Democracy Now! When we spoke to her last, as she went more deeply into the crisis that Lebanon is facing today. And that does it for our show. Democracy Now! Is produced with Renee Feltz, Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Messiah Rhodes, Nameen Sheikh, Marita Arsena, Tami Warrenoff, Tarina Nadura, Sam Alkoff. Special thanks to Julie Crosby. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available on our website at kboo.fm. Due to the temporary closures of in-station activity at KBOO, meetings will be conducted online via public video conferencing unless otherwise noted. A public link and phone number to attend the meetings are available on our website. The Program Advisory Committee meets on the second Tuesday of the month at 6 p.m. Please visit our website at kboo.fm to verify if a meeting is being held.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Portland bars and venues start requiring proof of vaccination. Oregonians organize demonstrations to prevent mass salmon die-offs. And in national news, Florida Governor Ron DeSantis doubles down against mask mandates while cases climb. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, August 5th, 2021. I'm Ethan Sandweiss. Following the lead of the San Francisco Bar Owners Alliance, some Portland bars and music venues are starting to require proof of vaccination from their guests. Bar Bar, Mississippi Studios, Teardrop Lounge, and Folk Magic Presents are among a group of businesses enacting or considering a proof of vaccination requirement. Some businesses will require proof of vaccination from all customers, while others consider creating vaccine-exclusive spaces or hosting specific vaccine-exclusive events. Business owners hope to move forward together to avoid any single business becoming a target for anti-vax harassment. The Oregon Nurses Conference meets this week to discuss equitable treatment for patients, regardless of race and ethnicity. For more, here's Eric Tegedoff.
Oregon nurses are holding a conference today on an important topic facing the health industry, equitable outcomes for patients. The Oregon Nurses Association's Health Equity Conference in Portland today and Friday is focusing on the different outcomes from the health system for people of color. For instance, the maternal mortality rate for black women is three times the rate that it is for white women. Deborah Riddick with the Oregon Nurses Association says nurses interact with patients at every level of care.
If we have that amount of access to patients, to communities, to their families, that it would make sense that if there's a problem like health equity, that we would be the ideal folks to be able to plug the gap and be able to use some of our knowledge and our skills to address the problem.
During the pandemic, Oregonians of color have faced disproportionate health impacts. Hispanic Oregonians make up 13% of the state's population, but are nearly 30% of COVID-19 cases where the ethnicity is known, according to state data. Dee Watkins is an editor-at-large for Salon and a writer who is speaking at the Health Equity Conference. He says stigmas around health care especially are strong for Black communities. Watkins says the words health professionals use are important.
Sometimes basic things like the way we use language when we talk about patients or when patients talk about these different institutions is the root of the problem, and it's what we need to fix if we want to be strong and we want to solve a lot of the problems that we have.
The Oregon Nurses Association has been working to promote health equity in the state through the legislature. Riddick says the union pushed for a bill this session that would have declared racism a public health crisis.
Unfortunately, there was not enough support for the bill, that it ultimately was reduced down to simply a resolution. A lot of the things that required funding were pulled out, which was a great disappointment to many of the community members that worked throughout session around the bill.
Despite the bill not passing, Riddick says it was a good learning experience for pushing this type of policy. She also notes that the House bill's chief sponsor, Lake Oswego Democrat Andrea Salinas, is on a panel at the conference. For Oregon News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
Warming temperatures in the Columbia River Basin are killing sockeye salmon. Rallies are planned Saturday in Portland, Boise, Seattle, Eugene, Corvallis, and Spokane, pressuring Congress to save the endangered fish. With the full story, again, here's Eric Tegedoff.
Rallies are taking place across the Northwest to support salmon, which face dire conditions in the Columbia River Basin. On Saturday, the Rally for the River is calling for action from Congress to save endangered fish species in the region, including removing four lower Snake River dams that impede salmon migration and heat up the river. Brett Vandenhoevel is head of Columbia Riverkeeper, which recently captured video of the sockeye salmon struggling in the warm waters of the Columbia.
The heartbreaking video of the sockeye covered in lesions and fungus should sound an alarm. We need action now from the Northwest delegation.
Water temperatures above 68 degrees can be lethal for salmon, and the Columbia already has been above 70 degrees this year. Vandenhoevel says temperatures that high stress out salmon metabolism and leave them more susceptible to predation and disease. He predicts the situation will only get worse unless leaders act to remove the Snake River dams. Betsy Emery with the Association of Northwest Steelheaders says anglers contribute $5 billion per year to the Pacific Northwest's economy, but she fears salmon in the basin are at a tipping point.
A lot of us who spend time on the river and spend time thinking about these fisheries are really nervous, thinking, could this be that catastrophic event that starts pushing some of these runs that we love so much from a fishing perspective into a space where they might not be strong enough to fish?
Vandenhoevel says people are becoming inspired to take action.
More and more people are getting involved and recognizing how serious and urgent this issue is for salmon, for the orcas that depend on them, for the people of the Pacific Northwest.
Rallies are planned for Eugene, Portland, Boise, Corvallis, Seattle, and Spokane on Saturday. For Oregon News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
So far this summer, 100 major fires have burned just shy of 2 million acres across 14 states. More than a quarter of the land burned is in Oregon. According to federal data, the number of wildfires in 2021 reached a 10-year high and continues to grow. The state's massive bootleg fire is now 85% contained, but according to the U.S. Forest Service, high winds from an emerging cold front could threaten to spread the flames to the north. In Northern California, the historic Gold Rush town of Greenville was destroyed today by the Dixie Fire. Portions of Yellowstone National Park in Montana are also in flames. Further east, communities in the path of wildfire smoke are experiencing health problems. As far as North Carolina, doctors are recommending that children and people with heart or lung conditions stay inside. With more, here's Nadia Ramlagan.
Massive wildfires in the western U.S. and Canada have triggered poor air quality in North Carolina over the past few weeks, and health experts say it's important for residents to know traveling smoke can cause more than hazy skies. Pediatrician and health programs manager at Clean Air NC, Dr. Stephanie Johannes, says research shows tiny particles can penetrate the lungs and cause a range of health problems.
We know that when that air from the West Coast shows up here in North Carolina, it's affecting our air quality here, and it's really putting putting people, everybody at risk for health problems, but especially those people that already have some heart or lung conditions, especially people with asthma.
The CDC says wildfire smoke can make people prone to lung infections, including the coronavirus. According to NOAA, a warmer and drier climate is expected to lead to more frequent and intense fires and smoke plumes, which in turn are expected to affect more people. Johannes points to research published earlier this year by scientists at the Scripps Institution of Oceanography at the University of California, San Diego, which found that the fine particles in wildfire smoke can cause more harm to human lungs than particulate matter from other sources, such as car exhaust.
There is a lot of data that shows that this particular kind of pollution contributes to mild symptoms like eye or respiratory tract irritation, but also to really severe things, worsening heart and lung conditions that people have and even causing premature death.
She encourages families with young children, the elderly, and those with a chronic disease to regularly check their local air quality index at airnow.gov. Air quality indexes use ozone and particle pollution measurements from 0 to 300.
Anything over 100 is unhealthy for people in those sensitive groups, and anything over 150 is something that's risky really for everybody.
Johannes recommends planning outdoor activities or exercising on lower air pollution days and says it's important to talk to your doctor or child's pediatrician about air quality concerns. This is Nadia Ramlagan for North Carolina News Service.
Heat-related illnesses are on the rise alongside global temperatures. Older adults are particularly high risk, especially if they suffer from diabetes or heart disease. Dr. Anthony Lizowitz has more on the story with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. Hot, sticky summer weather is uncomfortable and dangerous. It can cause heat stroke, and if people have underlying health conditions, it can even trigger crises like heart attacks.
When we look at major heat waves, you see that lots of people died not just from heat stroke, but from cardiorespiratory diseases. And it's because of the strain the heat puts on our various organ systems.
That's Christy Ebi of the Department of Global Health at the University of Washington. She says senior citizens are especially vulnerable because they often have chronic health problems such as diabetes or heart disease, and they may not notice the warning signs of heat-related illness.
Many older adults don't necessarily feel well on a good day.
So she says it's important to check on neighbors and family members when it's hot.
Do you have your windows and doors open? If you've got air conditioning, do you have your air conditioning on? Are you drinking sufficient fluids?
Cities can help by issuing early warnings about heat waves and opening cooling centers. As the climate warms, many parts of the country will see more extreme heat, so Ebi says it's urgent that communities take action to keep everyone safe. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To hear more stories like this, visit climateconnections.org.
A new study warns that kids are facing radio frequency radiation exposure hundreds of times above safe levels. Wireless devices and 5G technology are the leading culprits. Suzanne Potter has more on the story.
A new study shows the current federal limit for exposure to wireless radiation should be hundreds of times lower than it is for children. Researchers from the Environmental Working Group took methodology developed by the EPA to assess human health risks from toxic chemicals and applied it to radio frequency radiation from wireless devices, including cell phones, tablets, and 5G. Study co-author Dr. Olga Nydenko says standards should be updated, and in the meantime, she suggests parents take simple steps to reduce their kids' RF exposure.
Well, teaching children not to sleep with their phone under the pillow, that is probably a good first step. And for example, instead of clutching it to the chest, to put that tablet or the phone on the table.
The wireless industry says its products are safe and comply with Federal Communications Commission rules. But Nydenko notes the studies underpinning those standards are 25 years old and apply only to adults. A 2018 study from the National Toxicology Program linked wireless radiation to heart and brain tumors in rats. Nonetheless, the California legislature is considering two bills that would make it harder for cities to place limits on where new 5G cell towers can be installed. Dr. Jerome Paulson is a retired professor of pediatrics and occupational and environmental health at George Washington University. He says until 5G is proven safe, he supports local ordinances like those in Los Altos and Petaluma that require a 500-foot setback from schools and homes.
5G towers should be placed far away from human beings. The distance provides the protection because the farther away you get, the less energy gets to people.
Paulson thinks the government should set separate wireless radiation limits for children. The World Health Organization classified cell phone radiation as a possible carcinogen in 2011. This is Suzanne Potter for California News Service.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for Coast Range Radio. At 6, it's Rose City Native Radio, and then at 7, it's Hard Knock Radio. Tonight's weather is cooler, and there's a chance of rain in the early morning. Expect rain tomorrow and temperatures in the mid-70s, a much-needed reprieve. Today in history, the world's first electric traffic light was installed in Cleveland, Ohio. The quote of the day is from Japanese baseball player Ichiro Suzuki. If I ever saw myself saying I'm excited going to Cleveland, I'd punch myself in the face because I'm lying. Sorry, Clevelanders, that's his opinion, not mine. Richard Trumka, president of the American Federation of Labor and Congress of Industrial Organizations, died from a heart attack today at 72. One of America's most influential labor leaders, Trumka was known for his straight talk and steadfast support of collective bargaining rights. A coal miner turned lawyer, Trumka became the youngest president of the United Mine Workers of America at 33. He joined the AFL-CIO in 1995 and built close working relationships with leading Democrats such as President Joe Biden and Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer. Richard Trumka was a major player, not just as a labor activist, but also as a political campaigner, securing union endorsements for Democratic politicians. Despite his connections with the party, Trumka was unafraid to criticize Democratic policies that hurt workers, such as Bill Clinton's NAFTA pact. The AFL-CIO is one of the nation's largest unions, representing more than 12.5 million workers and playing a huge role in national politics. Texas Governor Greg Abbott called a new legislative session Saturday when the state's Republican lawmakers will again attempt to pass a sweeping attack on voting rights. Democratic lawmakers left the state in May to deny the legislature the quorum it needed to pass the restrictions. Governor Abbott threatened to arrest the lawmakers on their return. State Rep. Gina Hinojosa announced that Democrats would consider breaking quorum again to prevent the voting restrictions from passing. President Joe Biden called out Greg Abbott and Florida Governor Ron DeSantis for their orders banning mask and vaccine mandates. DeSantis has threatened to defund schools that require masks for their students. In Florida, where schools have been ordered to ignore CDC health guidelines, children under 12 have seen the steepest increase in case rates this month. Many children have been hospitalized, and Florida's hospitals are treating more COVID patients than at any point in the pandemic. Several school districts are denying the governor's orders despite DeSantis' threat to strip their funding. According to the Florida Hospital Association, 60% of hospitals are facing critical staffing shortages. Florida saw 110,000 new infections last week, over a fifth of cases nationwide. 39,403 Floridians have so far died from COVID-19. Meanwhile, DeSantis squarely blamed Mexican immigration for the COVID epidemic and the Biden administration for facilitating it. DeSantis wrote to supporters Wednesday, quote, "Joe Biden has the nerve to tell me to get out of the way on COVID while he lets COVID-infected migrants pour over our southern border by the hundreds of thousands. The falsifiable correlation between immigration and disease was often used in the 20th century to justify the exclusion of immigrant groups." The U.S. economy showed gains this year, but experts warn that the rise of the Delta variant could jeopardize economic recovery as well as human lives. With this story and others, it's Nadia Ramlagan with 2021 Talks.
Welcome to 2021 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
There are some indications that economic activity is beginning to weaken. So, you know, at least on the margin, we are starting to see some impact.
Mark Zandi, chief economist with Moody's Analytics, says the Delta variant could cause the U.S. to veer off course from an economic recovery if new mandates or lockdowns restrict consumers, or if consumers restrict themselves out of fear of contracting the virus. Senate Republican leaders held a news conference to discuss the Democrats' spending bill, which they say will lead to tax increases and more debt. Utah Republican Senator Bill Lee.
This bill would spend a staggering $1.2 trillion. It would be yet another inflation bomb in an economy that's already been carpet bombed by other inflation bombs.
Former President Donald Trump is challenging the U.S. Justice Department's order to hand over his tax returns. In a D.C. federal court filing, Trump's lawyers said the House Ways and Means Committee lacks a legitimate basis for seeking the documents. Senate Republican leader Mitch McConnell criticized the Biden administration's decision to pull remaining U.S. troops from Afghanistan as the 20th anniversary of the 9/11 terrorist attacks approaches. He warned the decision will have consequences for years to come.
The administration literally glossed over the risk of an al-Qaeda resurgence. But now, Secretary Austin is acknowledging al-Qaeda could reestablish a safe haven and threaten the homeland in less than 2 years.
A new poll finds most unvaccinated Americans don't blame themselves for the recent surge in COVID-19 cases across the U.S., pointing instead to international travelers, mainstream media, and President Joe Biden. Cape Fear Valley Hoke Hospital President Dr. Roxy Wells says North Carolina, where just 43% of the population is vaccinated, and other southeastern states are seeing a surge of cases.
We know here in North Carolina and across the country, individuals are getting the virus at increased numbers, and we want to ensure that our state and really people across the country are well protected.
As the global total of COVID-19 cases surpassed 200 million Wednesday, the World Health Organization is calling for a moratorium on coronavirus vaccine booster shots to allow vaccine access to countries struggling to obtain their first shots. Mexico is suing U.S. gun makers, accusing them of reckless business practices that supplied what it called a torrent of illegal arms to violent Mexican drug cartels, leading to thousands of deaths. The lawsuit alleges units of Smith & Wesson, Glock, and other firearms manufacturers knew their business practices encouraged illegal arms trafficking into Mexico. I'm Nadia Ramlagan for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
Thousands of Aboriginal Australian children were kidnapped by government officials between 1910 and 1970 and sent to boarding schools. Survivors of the stolen generations are now eligible for reparations from the federal government. Prime Minister Scott Morrison said today, "This is a long called for step. To say formally not just that we're deeply sorry for what happened, but that we will take responsibility for it." The Closing the Gap implementation plan is set to distribute $378.6 million Australian dollars over 5 years to Indigenous communities. Individuals taken from their families as children may receive each a one-time settlement of $55,000. According to the Australian Institute of Health and Welfare, only 12% of the stolen generation graduated high school, and 66% did not own a home. 43% struggled to pay basic living expenses, and 43% have been diagnosed with mental health conditions. Today, Aboriginal Australian children are still 10 times more likely to be removed from their families than children from other communities. California's Passamaquoddy tribe has long lacked access to clean water on its reservation. Chief Maggie Dana is working with the state of California to address the problem, hoping to expand laws regarding tribal sovereignty. For that story and more, it's Trip Krause with National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Indigenous news, issues, and culture.
This is National Native News. I'm Trip Krause in for Antonia Gonzalez. For decades, members of the Passamaquoddy tribe in Maine have complained about the color, smell, and excess contaminants in their water. But as Robbie Feinberg reports, tribal leaders are hoping new efforts could offer a solution.
For decades, Plantawes Dana and other Passamaquoddy tribal members say they've had to purchase bottled water or use this spring, 10 miles from the reservation in order to access clean water for drinking and cooking.
Growing up, my parents always said, don't drink the water, the water's not good for you. And so I have a childhood memory of always looking for different well places to go to, and we would go and fill our jugs and bring them home, and that was always a rule in my house. My parents would never drink the water.
The issue is the tribe's water source, a nearby lake. The water is full of organic matter, such as leaves, and requires substantial treatment. Public officials point to water samples showing the water is safe, but several recent results show the water has exceeded federal limits on trihalomethanes. Those are contaminants resulting from the disinfection process that federal authorities say may increase cancer risk and liver and kidney problems. The tribe has been looking at different solutions for years, including partnering with the state on a new carbon filtration system at the local water district. But Chief Maggie Dana says the tribe is pushing for changes to the state's laws governing tribal sovereignty, which she says would make it easier for the tribe to acquire lands and use them as a water source. For National Native News, I'm Robbie Feinberg.
The Bureau of Land Management opened a 30-day public comment period for a controversial mining project in an area about 1 mile from California's Death Valley National Park. About 170 miles north of Los Angeles, Canadian junior mining company K2 Gold proposes to collect samples for gold analysis in part of an area known as the Conglomerate Mesa. Kathy Bancroft is the Tribal Historic Preservation Officer for the Lone Pine Paiute Shoshone Reservation.
So now they're applying for huge permits. They're applying to put roads in and dig 120 new sites, new wells, or drill holes to see what else they can find up there.
Opponents of the mine say the project could do harm to the wilderness, public lands, and cultural sites of the Tumbisha Shoshone and the Paiute Shoshone. Bancroft worries that the move to green energy will put a larger demand on mining metals for things like car batteries.
So we have people in Congress that just think that mining, we got to just be able to open up a lot more mines without thinking of the consequences. You're trying to do a green energy project, yet you're going to open it up to destroy millions of acres of public land and the water supplies, because mining takes a huge amount of water.
The public has until August 30th to submit comments, which can be done through the Bureau of Land Management's website. The Public Health Authority for the Umatilla Reservation is recommending universal mask use in public indoor settings throughout the reservation. Yellowhawk Tribal Health Center announced the move in response to growing numbers of COVID-19 cases. The Crow Tribe will bring 3 misdemeanor charges against a Bureau of Indian Affairs agent involved in a traffic stop in Lodgegrass, Montana, that resulted in one man's injuries. According to KULR8-TV, the complaint filed in Crow Tribal Court alleges that on July 20th, the canine handler was working for the BIA and responded as a backup officer to a call in Lodgegrass. The complaint continues to allege that during the stop, the agent deployed the dog while the victim was already on the ground and struggled to control his canine. The 3 charges of aggravated assault, criminal endangerment, and negligent endangerment are all misdemeanors, the highest level of charges available in tribal court. For National Native News, I'm Trip Krause.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, August 5th, 2021. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. The producer tonight is once again me, Ethan Sandweiss, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Nadia Ramagan, Trip Krause, Richard Tegedoff, Anthony Lizowitz, and Suzanne Potter. The director of the evening news is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/evening news. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282 BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Ethan Sandweiss. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO, The Gap at 8 a.m., a talk show aimed at bridging the generational divide.
You are listening to KBOO Portland.
Thank you for tuning in to Coast Range Radio, a radio program of the Coast Range Association. My name is Andrew. Thanks for tuning in on your local community station. We really appreciate those local stations and their support of the radio program. If you're listening on the podcast, check and see what your station is in your town. There's some great other programming, and they provide a valuable resource. I want to hear from you and hear what you think of the show. Folks should send us an email at andrew@coastrange.org and let us know what you like and what you're thinking about the different guests, the things we're talking about on the show. So I'm really excited today. This is an interesting and a unique program. We're doing a two-part series focusing on land ownership, rural landscapes, and the Green New Deal. And today we have a really unique guest for Coast Range Radio. He is an assistant professor at George Mason University in Fairfax County, Virginia, who focuses on environmental justice, food and agriculture, sustainability, conservation science, and policy. He's a human geographer whose work focuses on environmental injustice, particularly issues surrounding food, agriculture, and land use. His current research examines the environmental justice implications of conservation easements, an increasingly common form of publicly subsidized private land conservation. He is also developing a long-term project on land ownership in the Shenandoah Valley of Virginia. Welcome, Levi Van Sant.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Hey, yeah, it's awesome that you're taking the time to talk with us here on Coast Range Radio. I reached out to you a little while ago. Your work, and we found out about your work through an article you wrote in Dissent titled Land Reform in the Green New Deal. And you know, that piece was very informative to some of the work that the Coast Range Association has done regarding industrial forests, Wall Street ownership, and land reform in Western Oregon. And that recently released proposal really, you know, drew a lot from this article you wrote in Dissent. So I just, you know, I sent you an email. I said, hey, we really appreciated this work. It's some of the only writing that's available on this subject, and it was very informative. We learned a whole lot. So I really appreciate you taking the time to come and kind of dive a little deeper into this subject matter, land ownership, land reform, these types of things. Rural ag and issues. And so, yeah, thank you so much for being here on Coast Range Radio.
Thanks. Yeah, it's I'm glad to hear that y'all found that article useful. You know, a lot of times you write things and they, you know, you never hear anything about them. So it's great to hear that y'all found that useful and reaching a broader audience. You know, a lot of times as academics, we are in our sort of small circles. So it's good to break out of that. So thanks for reaching out to me.
Yeah. Did you get some responses to that Dissent article? Or did you get?
I did. Yeah. It's one of the things that I've written that had a broader circulation, you know, than some of the more traditional academic things that have a narrower reach, smaller reach. This one, you know, and that was one of the reasons I was excited about it, because Dissent does have a broader audience. So, but it does seem like it resonated with a fair amount of folks, and I was glad to hear that and look forward to, you know, keeping these conversations going.
Great. Well, to kind of just jump right in to learning a little bit about your research and this work, you know, what originally got you interested in researching and writing on land ownership and environmental justice issues? And what were some of those personal experiences that maybe inspired this work?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, there's so many, so many things that led me to where I am. But I do, you know, remember from a young age, I grew up in on a dirt road in rural Georgia. So I, you know, remember from a young age wanting to understand change in the countryside. It seemed like a kind of dynamic time. I think that's probably the case for everybody of every generation.
Yeah.
But I mean, I remember, you know, as a kid, when we would drive into town, we passed a bunch of peach fields on the way into town, but, you know, probably I was maybe around 10 or 12 years old, and all the peach farmers in our area just decided they got out of peaches. You know, it had been a couple of bad years, and then there was a late frost, and the kind of writing was on the wall, and so they decided to get out of peaches. And you know, I just remember driving past these fields with where they had pulled up peach trees, you know, hundreds of acres of peach trees just, you know, with the root balls sticking up in the air.
Yeah.
And so it was a really dramatic, that's one really kind of dramatic thing that sticks with me. But yeah, I wanted to have a better understanding of why things like that happened. You know, what are the political and economic and cultural forces that lead to rural change? So at other points after undergrad, I had sort of, you know, gotten some, you know, I got a degree in history and learned some more about these things. And I decided to do some work on, I had done work on farms as a kid, but I started doing more work on sort of local sustainable organic farms in Georgia. And, you know, I didn't know that I was going to go back to school. I thought, maybe I'll do this. You know, I was really interested in that, in the possibilities of local sustainable small scale agriculture. But I soon realized that there's a lot of difficulties. There's a lot of barriers to entry, as sort of one of the formal terms, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Basically land access, you know, it's difficult if it still takes money to make money, you know, even if you're talking about small scale agriculture, even if you're just talking about a couple of acres, it can be really expensive. So yeah, I realized that wasn't an option for me. And I went back to grad school to study, barriers to entry.
Interesting, interesting. That's actually, I have a similar experience. I got my undergrad and went into agriculture, working on small scale, locally owned farms. And I had a similar experience here on the West Coast. I think it's probably pretty universal in the States and all over the world that barrier to land ownership, or barrier that, you know, having that initial investment capital to compete with these large agricultural entities, these big investment firms, these large companies that have, you know, drive prices down, create, you know, huge, try to make the most efficient, you know, agriculture possible, lowering wages, contracting, mechanization, all these things make it really hard to compete as a small local, you know, sustainable agriculture operation.
Yeah, for sure. I think it's a pretty common experience, you know, over the past couple of decades, as that sort of movement has grown for, and the demand for local and sustainable and organic food has grown, and a lot of young folks are interested in it for good reason, you know, because it seems to provide you get to work outside, you get to potentially, you know, have some flexibility and be your own boss and you know, do something that's meaningful to you. And you know, and we're also sold this sort of agrarian dream about, you know, how you can work and buy your own homestead and provide for yourself.
Yeah.
And all
yeah.
this. And then, you know, the hard reality of it hits a lot of people. And so, yeah, there's some interesting work that people are doing to try to address that, but still a lot of challenges. So that was one of the things that, it led me to think about land ownership and questions of environmental justice more broadly.
Great. Yeah, you know, and it's something that I've learned a lot here working in Western Oregon and working for the Coast Range Association over the last couple of years. It's an agriculture issue, and then here in the West, it's a forest and timbering issue for sure. And when we were reading your piece, we were kind of like working through, you know, the Green New Deal came out, what was it, 2019? And was a really kind of transformative moment of thinking about the environment, the climate crisis, and just transition. And we were trying to apply that to forests here in Oregon, in industrial, Wall Street-owned private forests. kind of thinking through, like, how could these forests contribute to a climate solution? And we've kind of hitting a wall, not really thinking, feeling like we were getting to some of these root causes. And part of what your paper or your article in Dissent really helped us with is kind of like coming onto this idea of land reform. And, mm-hmm. you know, I was hoping you could kind of explain what is land reform, maybe in a U.S. context and then in a global context, if we want to go there. Is just, yeah, what is this idea and why is it so important for a kind of a just climate and environmental justice movement for specifically for rural folks?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, it's, you know, the history of land reform in the U.S. is not really very well known. And of course, you know, a term like land reform, without getting too deep into the weeds, the term is kind of loaded in and of itself, right? Part of this because of a kind of ideological backlash against sort of redistributive efforts, largely as part of the Cold War, right? So the term is kind of loaded. It can mean lots of different things, but for, you know, our purposes here and for what I was writing about in Dissent, and it is, land reform is a kind of politics that recognizes that control over and access to land is central to questions of social and environmental, to broader social and environmental issues, right? And so in the context of the U.S., land reform is largely about recognizing the concentration of land ownership and absentee land ownership and the ways that those things contribute to a host of social and environmental issues. I mean, I think it's also important to point out from the beginning that there are lots of people who have been struggling for control over land in the Americas for a long time, most notably, right, the history of indigenous struggles for land since colonialism began, right? So,
yeah, definitely.
So it's important when we, you know, think about this to recognize that while they, you know, indigenous peoples would actually oftentimes distinguish what they're doing from quote unquote land reform because it's a different kind of politics. But again, just important to highlight the kind of longstanding struggles for ownership and access and control of land. So what we're talking about when we talk about land reform and what I wrote about in this article then is this history that's not really that well known about a relatively recent national land reform movement in the 1970s, which is called the National Coalition for Land Reform. And I thought it was a really interesting example because, again, partly because of ideological reasons, people don't, you know, Americans don't often recognize that something like this has existed. You know, we tend to think of land reform as something that happens in the distant past or in, you know, the far away present, right? Somewhere like South America or South Asia or Africa, the global South. But that's not really the case. There actually have been land reform movements in the US recently and in a kind of coordinated national way, right? So that was one of the really interesting things that sparked me to look into this more. And as I did, I realized, wow, there's a lot of important things here that are still useful today. So
yeah, that blew me away when we were reading your article and like learned about this in the, what was it, the 70s, like you said. It was, there was a whole conference on land reform, this big movement. It was trying to bring together, you know, conservation folks, rural ag folks. It seemed very comprehensive. And one of those things is like, what happened? Why don't we know about this today? Why isn't it as broadly talked about? And you know what, it seems like for conservation, environmental justice, these types of things, like this history would be really important to learn about and to know about. And it was studying it for years and just finding it through your Dissent article, I was like, wow, okay.
Yeah, it's really bizarre. You know, I was shocked to find it too. Because again, I did a master's in history where I read about U.S. agricultural history, you know, for a couple of years, and I'd never heard of this, you know. I mean, there are a couple of reasons why, I think. One is that it didn't have a whole lot of impact. You know, they didn't achieve a lot of the policy goals that they had in mind. So that is one of the reasons why it's not as well known. Although, again, it was a pretty sustained effort. You know, it lasted for a couple of years. They had a couple of, you know, they had a series of publications and conferences and organizing efforts. So it wasn't just a total flash in the pan. So there's still the question of why it's not more well known. And again, I think a large part of that is ideological, right? It seems to be out of place, right? People assume that it is, you know, that there's no such thing as the national land reform movement in the U.S., and so nobody has really looked into it. That was one of the main goals of the paper, and is just to point out that this has existed, and in a kind of national organized form, and hey, we should think more about this and its relevance today.
Yeah. And so within, once again, back to the dissent article, you chose to discuss land reform and its connections to the Green New Deal, which I found to be super informative and helpful. Why did you choose, what's the thinking there of why is it so important to think about land reform in a climate crisis action and environmental justice? What's the connections in the value of land ownership, land reform in a climate crisis context in a just transition narrative that is put forward by the Green New Deal?
Yeah, I mean, when I first heard, you know, sort of increasing talk about the Green New Deal, I was excited that it was getting, you know, increasing traction, because I think, you know, obviously there's a lot we need to do about the climate crisis, and that the Green New Deal as a idea has a lot of purchase. I think there's a lot of important things going on there. But I was surprised as I looked into it more that there wasn't a whole lot of specific attention to rural issues, and particularly to questions of land ownership. And like I said, I had done a master's in history and was pretty familiar with the original New Deal of the 1930s. Rural questions, and particularly the land question, was central to the original New Deal. And I think, you know, some of its most important achievements were in that area. And also, a part of its political success can be contributed to the fact that it did confront rural issues. So I think there's both an ecological and a political argument for including rural issues and the question of land ownership in particular in the Green New Deal, just as there was in the original New Deal. I mean, first of all, the political point is that we have to overcome the sort of urban-rural divide, right? This is one of the main limits of the left, and particularly of the Democratic Party, in my opinion, is that, you know, they have in large part become a urban-centric party. And so you have huge swaths of the country that are that feel like their voice is not being heard. So, and you know, for good reason. So the political argument is that in order to address climate change, we have to bring together these urban and rural concerns and these urban and rural constituencies. And the ecological argument is that, well, you can't address climate change without dealing with land ownership. If we're going to do the kinds of things that are necessary to create a renewable energy economy, they're going to necessarily involve changing who has ownership and control and access to land. I mean, the most obvious example of this is the fact that fossil fuel industry has, you know, gets sort of massive giveaways from public and indigenous lands in terms of fossil fuel extraction. And that has to change to create a renewable energy economy. There has to be all kinds of infrastructure change as well. So, you know, there are very real political and ecological reasons that we have to think about this.
When you're, you know, working, teaching, and talking about land ownership, land reform, you know, specifically talking about large institutional owners and safe agriculture or other systems, Wall Street investment in land, what are some of the challenges you have in, you know, communicating this, working on these issues, and educating folks on them?
Personally, my experience, I can talk about a couple of things. One is, one of the challenges is just with the research itself, is the fact that property records are supposed to be public. Property tax records, for instance, are supposed to be public records, but they are incredibly difficult to access and make use of. I think your organization has also done some important work on this. You know, if you want to know who owns the vast amount of timber in your county, it's really hard to figure that out, even though there's supposed to be public records that do this. If you want to know how much land does the coal company own in Eastern Kentucky, it's really hard to figure that out. And if you want to figure out how much taxes they're paying, it's even harder. So,
yeah.
And these are things that, again, are necessary for the most basic kind of democratic process, right? Land ownership creates a lot of power and a lot of political influence. And, according to our democratic system, there should also be responsibilities for those with political influence and vast resources. And so understanding land ownership and taxation and these kinds of things is just incredibly murky. In effect, it's kind of privatized. And, you know, one of the things that's really frustrating about this is I'm doing some research here in Virginia now looking at land ownership rates. And I try to get the supposedly public information from the county officials. And the officials themselves are trying to be helpful, but the data that they can provide is not very useful. It's very difficult to use for a host of reasons. It's incomplete. It's this or that. But you can buy this same data, or actually better data, from a private, you know, a private firm, and it's much easier to use and much better quality data, much more extensive, et cetera. But it's incredibly expensive, and you have to buy it. It's something like $2,000 per county for Wow. this data, which is supposed to be public and free. So if you want to look into this for whatever reason, it's incredibly challenging just in terms of the data issue. So those that can get the best data are able to do the best analysis, and that's usually those with the most money, right? Like the real estate speculators and the investment firms, et cetera. So that's one, you know, sort of obvious challenge.
As similar, you know, we had that same experience here in Western Oregon with trying to figure out who owns these private forests, and we had to go county by county. Each county has a different process, a different system. Some charged, you know, thousands of dollars. Some it was free. It's like completely unstandardized, and all the data wasn't standardized either. So putting that together, when we finally put together our Western Oregon industrial forest ownership map, you know, it was ex- very hard to, and it can't be complete because the data is so different across these different counties. We had to code by tax address. So there's obviously pieces mm-hmm. missing. There's some, you know, it's just, yeah. It's
yeah,
and you've actually, there's folks out in the Southeast who are doing that in different states. You introduced me to some data in Alabama, was it, that showing ownership there, and that was really timber ownership, and that was super informative, really cool to see like similar work and similar issues happening across the U.S.
Yeah, that work that you're talking about, the Alabama Forest Land Ownership Project, is really interesting. And I don't know if maybe we can post links to these things in the show description or show notes.
Yeah, we'll definitely do that.
Yeah, for anybody who's interested, it's been really helpful to me. I'm glad it was helpful to you. It's they did some forest ownership mapping, and they basically said, okay, who owns the most forest land in the state? And they did it by county. You know, how many acres do these large firms own? What percent of each county in terms of, you know, sort of acreage is owned by these absentee corporate firms? And they put together a good website, you know, showing all of this stuff as a kind of public scholarship, public outreach, you know. Again, this should just be public information. You know, you can go to, when you go to the grocery store or the gas station, you know, you see a flyer with people's, you know, mugshots from when they were arrested. And that's public information, which arguably, you know, shouldn't be necessarily. It's being sold to make profit off of like people's worst day of their life. Yet you can't get this kind of thing. So yeah, I mean, you know, that reveals some of the priorities. Yeah, I mean, so it's really cool to see that project in Alabama. And, you know, one of the things that they do is beyond just showing that, you know, massive amounts of most rural counties, most of Alabama, are owned by absentee firms. They also show that there's as land ownership concentration and absentee ownership increase, that quality of life for the residents decreases. So basically, as measured by things like poverty, employment rate, education, food insecurity, all of these kinds of things, as you know, so it's a quantitative study basically, but you know, this builds on a lot of social science work showing that you know, land ownership, as it becomes concentrated and controlled by forces farther and farther away, there's less accountability, less sort of local power, and less equality.
Great. Well, we're going to end part one right there. Thank you, Levi, for this really informative stuff. Folks, thanks for tuning in. Tune in to our next episode in a couple of weeks, and we're going to continue the conversation with Levi, talking about some of these further challenges, and then talking about alternative ownership structures, some ways of thinking into the future of addressing these land ownership, rural land issues. Thanks for tuning in to Coast Range Radio. We'll talk to you next time.
listening to KBOO Portland.
The following program is a special encore rebroadcast for these unique pandemic times. Dates, times, and events mentioned in the following program have already occurred and are no longer relevant.
Tune in to Talking Earth, a show